Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and Boston Mayor Michelle Wu is on her way here from the first of her 2024 Neighborhood Coffee Hour series. We are expecting that arrival soon with us to both listen to the mayor when the conversation starts and to help set it up for us now. We have two friends of the show, an analyst, Yawu Miller, former senior editor at the Bay State Banner, and Gin Dumptious, reporter with Commonwealth Beacon. And Yawu, there is a lot to talk to the mayor about this month. Tons going on with money and buildings and summer jobs. What's on your mind today, Yawu Miller?
BPDA reorganization, I think, is I'm interested in hearing her perspective on it.
Boston Planning and Development Agency.
Exactly. She had ran on a platform of separating planning from development, of basically dismantling the, you know, what had previously been called the Boston Redevelopment Authority. And it seems like the criticism is that she's basically just taken a quasi-governmental agency that sort of operated outside of City Hall and brought it under the mayoral control, with the functions of planning and development still being run by the same person in the same department. Arthur Jemison is the head of the agency. And, you know, people want to see greater distance between the planning and development functions in the city.
So that's going to be an interesting one to press on. Gin Dumptious, over to you from the Commonwealth Beacon. Definitely things to press on with the mayor there. What else are you watching for in the conversation today?
Sure. The budget, the city budget, the hearings are getting underway, and kind of how it looks, what projections the city has in terms of what the next year or few years look like. You know, that's one of the biggest things that the mayor and the city council do every year. It's going to be the proposal is $4.6 billion, so largest municipal budget by far in Massachusetts. So that's what I'm interested in hearing more about.
Yeah, well, what about the mayor and the city council? This year, the anticipation was strong working relationship between the two. Mayor Wu endorsed several people who won seats on the council this year. What do you make of their relationship so far?
I think that you know, she has strong relationships with the majority of the people on the council. The last iteration of the council, there was a lot more pushback on a lot of her initiatives. So I haven't seen any major friction between the mayor and the council so far this year. Looks like it's pretty smooth sailing for her there.
And Gin Dumptious, as you focus in on the budget, as Yawu mentioned, the Boston Planning and Development Agency moving it in is a big chunk of the 8% additional spending that Mayor Wu wants for this coming year. But 5% left comes from other, you know, is results from other things like inflation, new collective bargaining agreements, other city expenses, controversy potentially over the ways Mayor Wu is thinking about paying for those things. She's looking for permission to raise commercial property taxes. What's important to understand there, Gin Dumptious?
Sure. With the BPDA, it's $42 million, and that's really kind of moving the agency from one part of the books to another. So the city is saying that's a revenue neutral move, but it does contribute to that 8% increase. And to Yawu's point about the, you know, what that does in terms of the overall overhaul reform of the BPDA, does it go far enough? I think that's going to be something that will probably get litigated on the campaign trail next year. She's going to be expected to be running for re-election, and it's going to be up to voters to decide. This was one of the things that she ran on in 2021, was abolishing the BPDA. Did she do what she say she was going to do? That's the question that's going to go before voters.
Again, you're listening to Radio Boston. Tiziana Deering here with Gin Dumptious, reporter with the Commonwealth Beacon, and Yawu Miller, former senior editor at the Bay State Banner. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu on her way here for our monthly conversation, coming from Billings Field in West Roxbury, where she held this morning the first of a series of neighborhood coffee hours. Yawu, what do you make of Mayor Wu is on her way in. We're going to do one of those real-time things. Yawu, Gin, we'll be back back to you towards the end of the show. You can probably hear the door close there as Boston Mayor Michelle Wu sits down in the chair across from me. Hello, puts her headphones on. Mayor Wu, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me. I'm sorry I'm late.
That's all right. Great to have you here. What did you hear from residents at Billings Field this morning in West Roxbury?
It was a great turnout. We had a lot of conversations, which is why I'm running in the door here late. And let's see, the big items were wanting to make sure that our seniors have the opportunity to continue the senior center that was created. And there was some question with the state budget funding. The city has been able to supplement some of that. Senior home repairs and the need for resources there. And so we had actually had a table with our Office of Housing providing some resources. We are doing a major renovation of Billings Field to include a street hockey section and complete renovation of the playground and other amenities there. And so it was a great day and beautiful sunny skies, so nothing better.
All right, so speaking of a great day and beautiful sunny skies, I'm going to dive right into all kinds of things that we need to talk about. I'm really aware that today is Earth Day. Let's start there. You have a new climate chief, Brian Sweat, set to begin on June 10th. You know, you ran as the Green New Deal for the city mayor. Brian Sweat has an agenda that you've set out. Here's the specific question for you. On Earth Day 2025, if he's had a strong first year, what's one concrete thing that is different in Boston's climate resilience?
One thing. Okay, I get squeezed into three. Okay, I'll pick two things. How about that? One is that day-to-day resiliency efforts and infrastructure will feel accessible to residents. We're doing really well right now with big buildings, with new buildings, new construction, with the state building code that's been updated that we've adopted and all that. But there's a lot of housing stock that is quite in need of retrofits, rooftop solar panels, flooding protections, and it's in that category of smaller housing stock, a little bit older, that we need to make sure there's a pathway for residents to feel like they have those protections too. And then I would say big picture, having a real sense of decarbonization and where our goals are going to be and how fast we can accelerate that. We're entering into the year where Boston is going to do an update to our climate plans, Climate Ready Boston, and this will be the window to set that all out and make sure that we are either affirming or accelerating as much as we can.
So Brian Sweat spoke with my colleague Lisa Mullins on WBUR's All Things Consider earlier this month. Here he is talking about changing perceptions of climate change.
We used to say, you know, climate change is going to happen to the next generation, and it is all around us right now, and we're feeling it in Boston, as is most of the rest of the world. For those who were in Greater Boston in the early 1980s, when they were writing songs about how dirty the Boston Harbor was, when we started that process and that big project, most folks thought Boston was crazy. There is no way we could clean up the harbor, and there's certainly no way we could do it without breaking the bank, and we did both.
So obviously, he thinks big things are possible. Part of what's on my mind in listening to that sound is the invitation from Pope Francis to you next month to go to Rome for a Vatican climate summit. Your subject is governance, health, and energy. Obviously, that is a global conversation. So you got a climate chief who's making big swings. You're invited to a global conversation on climate as the mayor of Boston. Do you, I mean, there's sort of one level of softball question. What's your global message, Mayor Wu? But what does Boston have to tell the rest of the world in a practical way about climate right now?
We have a lot to share, both in terms of what's possible and also in terms of how urgent it is. So as I understand it, there are a number of leaders at the state, you know, at the equivalent of governors or mayors represented, and they come from two kind of categories of geographies around the world, areas that have really taken on innovative leadership to show progress and how we can make things happen and begin to prepare or implement these solutions, move from planning to actually delivery and implementation. And then areas of the world or communities that are really living the intensity of climate change impacts, particularly through an environmental justice lens. Boston happens to fall into both of those categories. We are a coastal city. We are one of the most vulnerable regions of the world in New England when it comes to how quickly flooding and the changing weather patterns are going to affect our community. We feel the increasing heat already year by year by year. And we've also harnessed a lot of the collaborative spirit and resources in this area to implement things such as now making a very accelerated transition to electric school buses and electric vehicles and thinking about the transportation side. We have begun the city's first network geothermal pilot in partnership with the utilities, starting in public housing to rethink our energy sources. And we are incredibly ambitious in trying to ensure that on the housing side in particular, because we know our emissions come mostly from buildings within the city of Boston, that we can accelerate that progress and make it accessible to everyone.
You are listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, sitting here in Studio 2 with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, where there's lots to talk about, and I want to talk money, and we're going to jump right in here. You want to raise the budget 8% next year. Big areas for that: inflation, pensions, education, moving the Boston Planning and Development Agency. We'll get to that BPDA part in a second. I know that's a big chunk of it, and it's essentially revenue neutral. So I sort of want to ask about the other 5% when you take the BPDA out. And Mayor Wu, I kind of know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it this way on purpose because it makes it easy to draw out what I'm looking for. Does the city have 5% more revenue than last year to cover the 5% more spending you want to do in the non-BPDA part?
Yes. And in fact, unlike the state budget, for example, Boston is, every municipality around the state is required legally to have a balanced budget. And so we can only spend the exact amount or less that is available. And so I think it's actually helpful to talk about the revenue sources a little bit because it can seem counterintuitive with so many headlines about economic uncertainty around downtown. How does that actually impact things? Our revenue in Boston is largely based on property taxes. The downside of that is that when there is a shock to real estate, then we are more impacted than otherwise. But the upside of that, or the silver lining, is that it is a very stable place. Once the property values are assessed, you really have a good idea of what's coming in. Plus, for several decades now, cities in Massachusetts have been capped at 2.5 percentage point increase as the amount that their taxes can go up, property taxes can go up every year. And so between the balanced budget requirement and the Prop 2.5 limit, the increase in revenues from property taxes is quite set and bound, and it is what it is. The places where we go above the 2.5% then come from new property, that is new buildings that are coming onto the tax rolls that weren't previously included in what is subject to the 2.5% cap. And then other revenue sources such as excise fees or and permits, parking tickets, things like that, which actually factor in a little bit less, or they're much less of the total amount. But this last year, for example, the revenue coming in from excise was up almost 20%, just given how recovery from the pandemic has continued to go. And so and one other major point in terms of the revenue this year, sometimes there are things that are just based on the decisions of administrations long ago. One major building that came back onto the tax rolls this year was Landmark Center, which had been on something like a 20-year no taxes agreement to get the redevelopment going. And this happened to be the year that now an additional $20 million or so is coming onto the city's books because there had been an abatement in place for so long. And so that was a little bit of coincidence of timing, but it did factor in here as well.
We're going to do a bunch now on property taxes. You've laid that out. Obviously, that's a hot point right now.
Oh, and can I just say a tiny bit on the spending side? We might get into this as well. So of the 8%, again, a chunk of that being the BPDA, which comes with its, or the new planning department, which comes with its own revenue and therefore is offset because they're funded separately as well. there's less, it was 0.44% of the total budget is anything that is new spending. The rest of it is contracts and salaries for city workers that are finally settled, including the first year that our police contract will now be fully included in the budget, which includes a lot of reforms and cost of living increases that were not felt for multiple years when the contract was expired. And then other, the small investments include 12 new EMTs added to the staffing so that we can add an ambulance crew and ensure that response times stay down. Staff funding for revamping some of the technology platforms for permitting so that it could be more reliable and accessible to use the permitting system on all sides, from registering a new business to getting events up and running. A tiny bit for housing acquisition to continue the work that's been happening on ensuring that there's affordability on the housing front, and then making sure that we are doing right by the timeline to be fully funded for our pension system and to maintain that fiscal discipline.
I do want to do the taxes part, and we'll talk about commercial taxes in a minute. We did invite members of our texting group to send in their questions, and you can join that group by sending the word Boston to 617-766-0382. Alvin in Dorchester writes, many of us who have lived in Boston for years have pleaded with the mayor's office to push the legislature to modify property tax rules that reward rather than discourage long-term investment in a community by placing a limit on taxes for properties where a single family has owned and been resident for at least 30 years. Can you ask the mayor if she sees any change in property tax guidelines for long-term anchor residents of Boston neighborhoods to encourage stability and community civil investment?
Yeah, we are, as Elvin is alluding to, cities are quite bound by state tax laws as to any kind of discretion that we can have. What Boston does is we take the distinction between commercial properties and residential properties and apply a different tax rate as is allowed there. And we maximize the exemption that is given to residents just to try to reduce the burden on our residential, you know, property homeowners and renters as much as possible. We have put a provision up to the State House that is included in our transfer fee home rule petition that recognizes the unique burden that seniors have. And so it's not always necessarily the case that if you are a senior and if you've owned your home for 30 years, that's the same thing, but often it is part of the same universe. And so we, in our home rule petition, that would apply a very small fee at the point of sale for buildings over $2 million with some exemptions. That would, it would also include increasing the eligibility thresholds for seniors to be able to receive tax breaks or tax subsidies,
meaning it would be easier for some seniors if this home rule petition got passed. It would be easier for some seniors to get more tax breaks.
That's right. It would increase the income maximum that you could have to qualify for the tax breaks, and it would therefore nearly double the amount of the number of seniors who would be eligible for that. And it would dedicate a portion of the transfer fee revenue to ensuring that those would get help seniors stay in their homes. And so I am certainly open to other measures, but it does involve quite a complex process going through the State House.
So home rule petitions are a thing that you have to do because of, you know, unique governance standards here in the Commonwealth. When you want to make certain kinds of changes, you have to get a sign off from the city council. Then it goes to the legislature. If they say yes, then you get to do what you want to do.
And the governor.
Right. One of the things you want to do is have the ability to increase, as I understand it, the difference between what the private property tax rate is and the commercial property tax rate is, so that you could charge more in commercial property taxes to offset potential losses from vacancies. Just in a sentence, Mayor Wu, yes, I have that right, or no, I do not have that right.
Right now?
Yeah. No, that's what you want to do in your home rule petition.
Oh, you have that right. I see.
Yeah.
Yes. The big picture is that there's been a particular ratio of commercial to residential tax revenues. It's been 60-40 commercial,
right,
residential.
Right. And you want
to preserve that. No, we want to keep that the same. Meaning the amount, the tax rates vary each year. And because of Prop 2.5, they are applied to make sure that the total tax collection goes up by 2.5%, and that's it.
Yes.
And then they're applied separately to commercial and residential. With the amount that's come in, it's about 60% of the total property tax revenues have been from commercial, regardless of the tax rate, and 40% from residential. And the tax rate's adjusted to make it so. Given the fact that we may see some declines in commercial valuations, that would mean that if we applied the tax rates that we are able to, that ratio would shift more significantly onto residential. And so we just want to preserve things how they are now as close to possible and have the tools to be able to do so.
So essentially, you want to be able to charge more on the commercial taxes.
On the tax rates, just temporarily, so that we can preserve the same ratio so everyone's taxes are as close to what they were before. And I realize that this is, it's a more theoretical conversation than I like to have, but the timing is very complicated. The timing is unfortunate here in that when this happened 20 years ago, the city did not realize or did not put forward a home rule petition until after all the valuation data came in at the end of the calendar year. By then, the legislature was out of session as of July that or earlier that year. And so there was uncertainty as to whether this measure could pass in time for the January tax bills to go out. And they had to really rush it out the door. This gives us the time to have a full public process through the city council and the legislature to hopefully have the tools in hand as of July to use it if we need it in January. But so, it does mean that we won't have the full data until later in this calendar year.
So what I'm trying to do, and I did it poorly there, so I'm going to try again, is put my old teacher hat on. Basically, what we are talking about is, and you may or may not agree fully with the details of the report, but there was a report that came out, the Boston Policy Institute, February, showed Boston could face a cumulative commercial property tax shortfall of more than $1 billion in the next 5 years. There is an if property values go down, then essentially people would pay less on those properties, commercial, unless you make a change so that they pay the same amount.
Or they would likely still pay less, but just less of a decrease. Then. That's right. Exactly.
That's right. And you know that there is pushback that could drive businesses out. I'm going to give you a little bit of that sound. Greg Vassell, CEO of Greater Boston Real Estate Board, speaking with our senior producer, Amanda Beland, last week.
They have felt like second-class citizens since the beginning of the administration. And I was speaking with one owner the other day, and the person said to me, it's almost time for owners to vote with their feet and just head somewhere else.
Small business owners. Talk to small business owners right now. Tell them why they're not second-class citizens here in the city of Boston and why this would not be a cause to go somewhere else.
So I think Greg is probably talking less about small businesses and more about large commercial buildings. That's generally the constituency. And small businesses very often do not own their buildings or sometimes are in, many of our neighborhood small businesses are in mixed-use buildings that are just as much, oftentimes more residential on top of the first floor commercial. And so the impact here is on buildings that are commercial within the commercial tax classification. And so what's important here is that we know that there is uncertainty still from the pandemic and that there's been a lot of stress on supply chains and all sorts of costs. We know that interest rates are still at a 22-year high, which makes it very difficult for new investment and new growth, particularly in the real estate sector. The golden goose of Boston is our people. It is a community that is safe and healthy and has opportunity. And more than ever these days, I hear from businesses that their number one concern is the cost of housing for their employees, because that is what's driving recruitment and retention challenges for them. We need talent just as every other city needs talent right now. Staffing shortages across many, many industries. We've seen reports that people are leaving Massachusetts right now, and it is because of housing and of transportation reliability. Housing and transit are determining whether our golden goose of Boston is going to be able to continue thriving and growing here, the people and community of Boston. Businesses are following the talent these days. You see, that's why Lego is moving to Boston. There are many, many examples where companies want to come here. We have an unemployment rate in Boston, 3.2%. That is half a percentage point lower than the state unemployment rate, a full percentage point lower than the national unemployment rate. We have two soccer teams trying to come to Boston and be in the city or nearby the city. We have companies coming here, hotels being built.
You're
this
packaging
is
a
growing, a
lot here, right?
Thriving economy because people and businesses want to be here. We are the safest major city in the country. We are making investments for our young people, for seniors. And that is the kind of economic investment that makes it so that businesses are located with the best possible infrastructure and access to talent around them. To ask us to shift the burden onto residents in this moment ends up hurting businesses as well. And so I wish that we did not have to be in a place where we were worrying from the pandemic onwards about how a change in remote work and return to work is impacting downtowns. Every city around the country is having this conversation. And Boston, in fact, is in a much stronger place given our numbers and vacancies going down and commuter rail ridership going up. We see signs and evidence that things are moving in the right direction. But in order to ensure that in the very, very short term, we have every tool possible to protect our workforce, employees, residents, this is the legislative mechanism that's necessary.
Okay,
and in
so
the
I'm
medium to long
there.
Term, we need to work together to recruit more companies to Boston and continue doing what we're doing to make downtown residential and solve the longer term issue.
So I'm going to stop you there. There's a lot we have to get to. I'm starting to feel a little crunched on time. You gave a lot of answer there. I'm going to give you one follow-up question on that, and then I really need us to move on. Much of what you just said could all be true, and the people in that corporate building could be in Newton or Wellesley, and all the rest of that could be true. So are you not concerned that, I mean, there are vacancies elsewhere than Boston, and you can still enjoy that soccer team and the great culture downtown, et cetera. Have you no concern about that?
We need to work together as a region. It's not a, Boston's lost to Newton or Newton's lost to Boston or to Cambridge or wherever. This is one economy. And I see my role as, of course, fighting for the residents of Boston. And in this case, it's to make sure we are not exacerbating our housing crisis. But I don't believe that we're competing against Newton or Watertown or anywhere else in this area. When they thrive, we thrive. It's the same workforce. It's the same set of families, people who have relatives across all municipal borders here. We are one metro region. We are one New England region. And in fact, what we are up against is other parts of the country where people are making decisions about public safety, about access to healthcare, about great schools, about reliable transportation infrastructure, about safe climate infrastructure so that you can know that you're confident and healthy. And that's what I'm confident that we are making great strides in. There's no other city anywhere from public safety to public health, home ownership to childcare, where they are making this kind of investment and seeing this kind of progress.
Okay, I'm going to shift gears now. As you know, WBUR reported today that Boston police waited more than 3 years to arrest an accused serial rapist, Alvin Campbell. Even as the attacks continued, police only arrested him after a fifth victim came forward and then found evidence of as many as 11 women that had been assaulted. Have you spoken to the Boston Police Department leadership about this?
I have.
And what can you tell us?
Yeah. I think the most important focus that I want the conversation to have is on those who had the courage to come forward and that justice should be served in this instance. And there is a legal and investigatory process that is still playing out on that front. And it's really important that we preserve the integrity of that process. And so there are some limits as to what can and can't be said in this moment about that. I think there
Did
are...
Did they have an explanation for you about why it took so long?
These cases are, I think, when, you know, the law is very clear when it comes to sexual assault and certain categories of offenses about ensuring privacy and protections for those who come forward because it is so difficult to do so. There may be a larger public policy question about whether that is the right balance in this moment, but I know when we, you know, I've been involved in making sure that we could share information on previous incidents, for example, and there's always this tension between the requirement and the goal of being transparent so that there can be full accountability and public knowledge of whether what happened is what should have happened. And then the legal requirement that the confidentiality of victims and survivors who come forward is protected with the utmost confidence, that there's no chance that someone sharing their information or their complaint or story, that that will somehow become public through a different mechanism. And it does create a little bit of back and forth in doing so. But ultimately, the law is right now that those documents and that information is shielded from public records.
So the man accused of the attacks happens to be the brother of Attorney General Andrea Campbell, who was a Boston City Councilor at the time. According to Walt's reporting, both Medford Police and the Suffolk County DA's office has said that she had no impact on the cases. And I want to be clear about that. In addition, and this is from Walt's story, quote, Molly McGlynn, a spokeswoman for the Attorney General's office, said Andrea Campbell has recused herself from any involvement in the case, has no contact with law enforcement about the investigation or prosecution, and has not talked with her brother since his arrest, end quote. Here is Campbell in a statement to WBUR.
I remain horrified, heartbroken, and devastated by this case. I support survivors of sexual assault without qualification, and I will continue to pray for the survivors in this case who have shown tremendous courage in coming forward.
So, nevertheless, some experts that Walt talked to for the story said that the reality of her being a Boston City Councilor could have a chilling effect on decisions by a police department, the Boston Police Department. Are you satisfied that the Boston Police Department, with the information that you have now, and I recognize this is new, Mayor Wu, are you satisfied that they did not drop any balls here and that they were not reticent where they should not have been?
I had a quick conversation with the commissioner this morning just to make sure that I could be on the same page about and anything that I should know here, but I have not personally delved into any details. This is a matter that was before my time in this role and before Commissioner Cox's time in this role. But I know that in the process of the ongoing legal and criminal investigation here, that many more public details might be able to come out after such processes are over. And I just want to stand with the Attorney General in her focus on those who are at the center of this case, the victims and survivors who came forward, and to have that push for justice being served as the primary and only focus.
I'm going to ask one more question on this. In your collaboration with Commissioner Cox and in your vision of a reformed police force in the future, what would you want to be able to say in future cases, right? What's the goal for how law enforcement works with victims in the future when they are coming forward, having experienced sexual assault in the city that you run? What's the vision, Mayor Wu?
I think the reality right now, and would have to be in the future as well, is that there are multiple entities that tend to be involved here. It's the Boston Police Department, it's the District Attorney's Office, it's other community entities potentially, and often there is a need for close coordination between when a case or a complaint or allegation is brought forward and the levels of documentation and evidence and information that need to be present to reach the threshold to make an arrest or to take it further in the legal proceedings. And that requires all of those who will be involved being on the same page. I think most important is, with our legal system, one that both is geared to deliver justice, but also to ensure that there is due diligence and a right to for someone to have a fair process. We need to have clear coordination and nothing falling through the cracks on which party, which entity is to do what, and to have a clear set of standards as to when those thresholds are reached.
I'll pivot again, and thank you for that. We're here with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu covering a wide range of topics. I wanted to make sure we got there. We have time. I want to come to the Boston Planning and Development Agency. And there's a million ways that I could go at this, Mayor. Well, we've talked about it a number of times before. We've talked about the technical reasons that you want to do this. I know that you are aware that there are sort of two sets of reactions out there to this move to bring the BPDA under the city, Arthur Jamieson working for you underneath. One set of reactions, listen, the history of this agency in all of its previous versions has let the city down. It was part of urban renewal. We need something different. Another set of reactions, this is a power grab for the city. And while the city has done lots of communicating and talking with neighborhoods, that doesn't mean that we have actually affected anything. And we won't, because now the mayor has direct control over the Boston Planning and Development Agency. I know you know both of those things are out there. So take that head on and sort of answer it straight up.
The argument that this is somehow centralizing control is, I mean, it's, if you think about the whole, if you go into the whole history of how we got to the organizational structure that I've been trying to change, it was about concentrating control in the mayor. The mayor's office, and the mayor gets to appoint the BPDA board with the exception of one seat that the governor appoints, and then has plausible deniability as to decisions that they make. It's separate, but they actually still very much are in control over that. And now this department is officially subject to the same accountability, city council budget processes and other votes and accountability as any other city department. So the fact that it is, you know, this agency will now have no staff on their own separate from city staff, that's a very different operational reform. The transportation department, the environment department, arts, small business, housing, those departments all work in some around the same set of issues as well. Do we have communities where people have access to everything that they need? And the zoning code is actually supposed to be not just about deciding which developer gets the rights to get a special exception from the rules, but to actually set the rules so that they foster and push us toward building the types of communities that are needed today. And I promised the city when I was running for this office that I would give up the power that comes from having the BPDA off the books as a separate entity, only accountable to the mayor and not to the city council or anyone except for the BPDA board that the mayor appoints. And now the entire staff is going to be, with the exception of some that are grandfathered in because of employment and pension related issues, but essentially the entire staff will be city employees, just like every other department. I cannot overstate how significant a change that will be. And the types of initiatives that they're already taking on in terms of rezoning, of thinking about our processes for development review, we are already seeing many of the changes to make the rules actual rules rather than a set of guidelines that you can know someone who knows someone to get around.
So just very briefly, because we're just about out of time, Tom and Roslindale texted in asking how you think Squares and Streets is going. That's the rezoning initiative. In a sentence, how do you think it's going?
It's still very early. We have started with two neighborhoods, Roslindale and Hyde Park, and they are both in the first half of the small area planning process. And so we're still gathering feedback. It's been great attendance at the meeting so far. So I think we're seeing some success in the engagement and certainly the interest in community members wanting to drive this process is there. And I'm really grateful to everyone who's taken part so far.
And if somebody wants to trace their feedback to the final product, how do they do that?
They're you can follow along either with the website, where there will be minutes and notes posted after different meetings. There will be the goal is to have a consistency to the process as well. So each meeting is to focus on a different kind of topic that's related to planning. And then 6 to 9 months down the line, there will be decisions and proposals made about what the actual zoning changes would look like.
All right. Celtics and Bruins are both in the playoffs. You've got this Canal Street playoff hub when things are at TD Garden. The streets closed down. Will you make it to any games?
Yes, I will definitely make it. I didn't go to any of the first ones yet, but it's thrilling. These are great, great teams who really are wonderful community members on the court and ice and off of that as well in our community. And I'm so excited to see how far they take this.
Is this the Celtics year?
I'm knocking on everything around here. Fingers crossed.
All right. Fingers crossed. You heard it, Celtics. The mayor's got her fingers crossed for you.
Boston. Well, when Jason Tatum came to the school, he promised that this would be the year.
Oh, well, now it's on. Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, thanks so much for coming in. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We've just had a conversation with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, and now Yawu Miller, former senior editor at the Bay State Banner, and Gin Dumptious, reporter at Commonwealth Beacon, are here to give us some reactions and help us put it in context. Gin, let's just start with your general reactions to the conversation. What did you hear?
Well, I thought it was interesting touching on the Attorney General Campbell and the report this morning about her brother. I think some important context to layer in there is that when she was on the city council, she was a police critic. When she was running for mayor in 2021, as was Wu and Anissa Zabi George, Campbell clashed with the head of the police union who actually brought her brother up. So I think in the sense of having that kind of political background, this really becomes a story about what police could have done and could they have done it more, despite that, and that history there.
And you can find that story on WBUR.org. And again, the heavy emphasis in the story from reporter Walter Wuthman is on historic inaction, both, here but across the country when it comes to responding to claims of sexual assault from victims, lots of different places. Yawu Miller, turning to you, what was your main reaction? What did you key in on most in the conversation with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu?
I'll second what Gin said. I think people often overestimate the power that city councilors have vis-a-vis police, particularly, given that so many councilors, are trying to hold their feet to the fire and trying to get more accountability and clashing, as Campbell did with the police department. What I found most interesting was that you really see the mayor trying to, get the right balance of, the real estate tax for residents versus businesses, that affordability in Boston is the leading problem that that residents of Boston will bring up, and I do think that she has a compelling case to make before the legislature. Boston produces way more revenue for the state than Boston actually retains. For every dollar of tax revenue, Boston generates 75% of it goes out elsewhere. So the state has a vested interest in making sure that Boston has affordable housing, that Boston has good transportation, and it's the mayor's job to get all those things right.
So interestingly, when we reached out to members of our texting group for their comments and questions, Brian in Boston wrote, as a retiree working a few weekends, I'm paying 60% of my income for rent. Mayor Wu and Governor Healey must find better ways to accelerate real affordable housing. And we will actually be at the State House speaking with Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey on the show tomorrow, so we'll be able to talk with her about it as well. But this is a big issue on the minds of residents, Gin Dumptious. And Boston Mayor Michelle Wu did, sort of sort out the balance between commercial real estate taxes and, residential property taxes. One of the open questions is whether that, bill makes it all the way to the legislature, the home rule petition in the first place. Here's a little bit of sound from immediate past City Council President Ed Flynn and Councilors Aaron Murphy and Julia Mejia at a government operations hearing on the 16th. And this sound is courtesy of Boston City Council TV.
I'm concerned about whether an increase on commercial property taxes will negatively impact the struggling downtown office market.
How do we make sure that we're being fiscally responsible at the same time, not putting an added burden on our downtown commercial real estate, and figure out how to make sure that burden doesn't get passed on to our residents, which we all hear from. It's a balance that we have to tackle together.
I worry about this whole idea of pitting different groups against each other, and I am really curious about the moment and the reason why now.
What happens, Gindumptious, if the home rule petition never even makes it to the legislature, if this is not an option for Boston Mayor Michelle Wu?
Sure. Well, I mean, they City Hall has called this a precautionary measure, but if it doesn't go through and the commercial values decline and you're seeing you're going to see less revenue on that side, then that means property taxes on residents and also renters, because they'll get some of those costs passed on to them. Those will go up.
And Yawu Miller, Mayor Wu made a strong argument. Listen, that is a non-starter, and the concern about driving businesses out of the city really doesn't stack up compared to the level of concern there.
Yeah, I think people may be overstating the case about businesses leaving. You know, also she pointed out that, you know, a lot of the small businesses are on the first floor of a residential building in Boston. You know, taxes are a minefield for any elected official, and you know, you can't make a move without angering one constituency or another. But they're also how we pay for all the things we want in Boston, for our schools, for everything, you know, public safety. So I think that she's making reasonable demands.
All right. Yawu Miller, former senior editor for the Bay State Banner, still reporting for the Banner. Gindumptious, reporter with Commonwealth Beacon. Thanks for the beginning and the end of the show, giving us some perspective on Boston Mayor Michelle Wu.
Thank you.